Hi everyone. Before we get started with today's episode, I need to address some recent news. And also I want to issue a trigger warning for the next minute or two. I'm going to be talking about sexual assault. So if that's trigger for you, fast forward a minute or two until we get to the start of the episode. So at the end of February 2020, a woman came forward with the story that alleged that Timothy Hutton raped her shortly after he became famous. I don't want to go into the details here, but the story was originally published on BuzzFeed News. So if you want to read the full account, you can go there and find it. What I do want to make clear here is that we here at Let's Go Steal a Podcast believe the victim and we stand with her. I've discussed this issue with my other co-host, and we honestly did consider just stopping the podcast altogether. But we have, at this moment in time anyways, decided to move forward. While none of us would currently support a Leverage reunion, the fact is we were fans of the show before these allegations broke. We're going to do our best to separate the character of Nate Ford from the actor who played him. And as always, we're going to apply a critical eye to what the show is saying in every instance, just the way that I feel that we have for the past three seasons of the show. But as the story develops, we might need to change this. But as this story develops, we might need to change this approach. And I'll keep you updated as we, you know, as the story develops, we may need to change this approach though. And I'll keep you updated if we decide to do something different. And as always, I welcome, And as always, I welcome your thoughts on how we should handle this going forward. Thank you, and let's move on to this episode of Let's Go Steal a Podcast. A lot of stuff,
and I actually did a little quick sort of rewatch of the last part of it because there was so much to unpack for someone who used to work in a Wall Street adjacent job, by the way.
Oh, thank God. Because I don't understand any of this stuff, and I've like, it doesn't matter, like I've read The Big Short, like anytime I try to understand anything to do with the stock market or any of these things, My brain, first of all, cannot hold numbers. I can hold the most obscure, minute trivia and things that are not, I mean, not important, but like, but a number, I can like walk away from my desk with a Dewey Decimal call number in my head and I will like walk through 30 feet and forget it completely. I just, they don't stay.
I am one of those people too. And you know what helps me to remember numbers beyond my sort of, and by the way, we have picked aquatic nicknames and mine is the guppy. It should possibly be the goldfish because I have the same kind of lack of memory for numbers. But you know what helps me is if I say it out loud.
No, I can do that. I can be saying it, repeating it, repeating it, repeating it as I walk towards the shelves with the patron. Yeah. And then I'll get there. I'm like, it's 636.74.
Yep.
I don't know. Okay, let's walk back to the desk.
Yeah, I know. I write them down on scratch paper because, well, we don't use Dewey. We use Library of Congress. So they're even more.
Oh my God, that's even crazier.
Arcane. Yeah, they're crazier and they make more sense at the same time, but only if you're a cataloger. And we all know that those people, bless them, they are valuable and wonderful, but oh my God, their brains work so differently from ours.
I know, my cataloging class in grad school,
Yeah.
Oh, this got real. We just got real technical here for everybody else who's not in your grace. But yeah, my cataloger at work like held my hand and literally dragged me through that class. I was just like, Keith, I don't understand. I know what metadata is, but I also don't know what metadata is. And he's like, we talked about this yesterday. I'm like, please help me. I have to build a database.
My husband is not a cataloger, but he's much more of a cataloger type than I am. And he has for a large part of his career, has been a technical services librarian, mostly working in acquisitions. So he gets that more than I do. So he helped me a lot too.
It's like a magic power, I swear to God. So, but yeah, numbers like this, like money and stocks and like the terminology behind it, you can explain it to me every day until your face turns blue and I'm going to forget it 2 seconds later. So,
and I won't try to explain too many arcane Wall Street concepts to you because it, you know, frankly, it's not that much fun, but I did work for over a dozen years for the NASDAQ stock market and in various investor relations positions for publicly traded companies. So if you do have questions that, you know, and I will try to keep them as simple as possible because I'm actually, for the library I work at, I'm kind of the resident expert on securities and trading and et cetera. And so I will try to answer things. One of the things I thought about this episode, just to like actually bring it back to the episode, oh my God, and
I don't like worries. Groundbreaking.
What a concept. I mean, I don't, you know, please feel free.
In a second, I'll definitely introduce the episode and who we are and everything. Yes.
There's two movies that this episode calls back to in a huge way, I think. One of them, of course, is Trading Places.
Okay.
With all the, you know, learning about the stock market and, you know,
and that's Eddie Murphy and
Dan Aykroyd.
Yes. Right? Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, the two wonderful older gentlemen who are now both passed on, but I'm not remembering actors' names today, so okay, but it does really recall Trading Places with its, you know, crop reports, and is it the fake crop report or the real crop report, and how are you manipulating somebody's behavior to do a thing, and you know, all of that. It's like, that's like the actual plot of Trading Places. The other thing, it's how they get the, you know, the old guys who have the entire $1 bet that ruins Dan Aykroyd's character and elevates Eddie Murphy's character. It's okay. All about orange juice.
Also making the connection to trading, like stock trading and Trading Places.
Hey!
I think I saw that movie as a wee child and I don't remember anything about it.
Like I said, I'm old. Both of these movies are from the 80s. So we have Trading Places. And then we also have a mini callback in Ecuador to Romancing the Stone.
Yep. I have never seen Romancing the Stone. And I know that I would love it, is the problem.
Adore it.
It's like right up my alley. Like, yeah. I feel like the mummy is like a stepdaughter to it. And I just am not. I don't know what's wrong with me.
You just need to watch the movie. You need to have Joan Wilder in your soul because she is just the best.
Okay. Absolutely. I'll see if it's streaming anywhere. Yes. I'll watch that this weekend. That's my vow to you. I will watch
best
that.
Best Kathleen Turner role ever, ever, ever.
Ever. Okay. Now that we have those movie recommendations for later this weekend, start actually talking about this episode. So... Yeah. Belatedly, maybe I'll put some more of the theme music right here to like actually start. Welcome back, everybody. I am Christina the Coral Reef Hicks, and I'm joined by Adele the Guppy Buck. We decided to go in keeping with this week's episode to give ourselves aquatic nicknames.
Of course.
And because we're going to be talking about the Boiler Room Job today, which aired on August 21st, 2011. It was directed by Arvin Brown and written by Paul, I'm still probably screwing up his name, Guyot, who this is his second episode that he's done for Leverage, and his first one was earlier this season. I forgot which one it was. But, you know, it was earlier this season. I just go back a couple episodes, I talked about him. So in this episode, going up against a con man who knows all of the tricks in their repertoire, the team has to take a different tack. And they also find out some new information about two members of the team and about who's been bugging them. Mm-hmm. Literally and figuratively. our very first scene, I love the mood that the set just gives. Like, it's an unfinished office building with like plastic sheeting hanging, and it's all very blue and cold looking, and we meet the Mako.
The worst.
His name's something Sherman. I just call him Sherman the whole time.
Brad Sherman, is it?
Greg, because at some point Parker calls him Craig and he's like, it's Greg. Which is the recurring getting his name wrong, whether it's his real name or his nickname is so great. It's just like the best way to neg somebody.
Well, it's the best way to neg this kind of somebody.
That's true, yes, because he's very about his...
He's so self-important.
...reputation and who he is. Yeah.
He's not like his reputation, but his lineage.
Yeah.
I think this character has a lot of insecurity about his lineage, and he's got something to prove because he's got these famous, infamous forebears that are famous, you know, were exceptional grifters.
Big old stolen shoes to fill.
Yep.
I have thoughts about that and information about that I'm excited to get to. But yeah, he is instructing this room full of white guys in suits how to swindle people out of their money. And we get to watch him swindle our victim, like on the phone live.
Right.
And he convinces her she's got to do this for the kids.
Yeah. Oh, and I think his first word is gentlemen, which is so bleeping telling, you know, because first of all, yeah, you're all white dudes, and second of all, oh no, you are the last thing from a gentleman. You are nothing like a gentleman. So sorry, not sorry. Hashtag
good try.
Yeah,
you might be wearing a suit, but that does not a gentleman make.
Yes, and might I add that the costuming for him is really genius, because there are a variety of ways to wear a pocket square, and he's always in that very sharply cut suit, and he always has like a sort of a shark's tooth pocket square. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
That's such a good point.
Yeah,
I didn't notice it until the scene when he and Nate and Hardison are together, like on the balcony, mm-hmm. like looking down into the lobby, and that's when it like really popped out at me. But yeah, shark's teeth.
It popped out at me actually in Ecuador, because it was actually framed in the shot as he was telling Elliot the Mako, like, and it was like right there, and I was just like, ooh, nice. Nicely done, costume people.
You know who that is? That's Nadine, their costumer. She's fabulous. She's so good. Okay, so while we're getting his instructions, it's paralleled with McSweeten, Agent McSweeten, and the FBI, along with Agent Bob.
Yes.
Because Taggart's been attacked by ferrets. Which is so, I love, just a dropped thing and not explained. Like, why was he attacked by ferrets? Was this one of his like weird things?
Why Hall & Oates? I mean, just why? You know, just to call back all the way back to season one. Like, why? No explanation. It's just funnier that way.
And just Agent Bob going, what? Ferrets? And then like, okay, now we got to go to this job. But they bust into a room that ends up being abandoned, and there's a note on the phone that says, better luck next time. Because that's how good Greg the Mako Sherman is. He's always one step ahead of the FBI.
Yes.
But you know, I love, like, you know, we're in season four and we are so accustomed to our team. We're like, why would you need to be ahead of the FBI? You can work with the FBI and still, you know, get your work done. So this isn't impressive to us, the viewers. But it does kind of show that he, you know, he's not just your run-of-the-mill con artist. He's
right.
He knows what he's doing. And then we get our victim, whose name is Sheila, and she's, you know, explaining one, which I really love, like the police told her this is a learning experience for her.
Yeah.
And she should have gone to a legitimate stockbroker. She's like, I don't know what the difference is. Like,
right.
I thought this was, I wasn't on purpose going to a shady guy. I thought he was legit. Mm-hmm. And she's lost like $72,000 of donations and grants for her special needs school.
Right.
That gives like free tuition to kids.
And I'd like to step in here. One of the things that they didn't do with this episode, which I thought could have been interesting, although it probably might have been too complicated, is that there is a thing that a lot of swindlers like Sherman do, which is called affinity fraud. Have you ever heard of this? And it's basically taking a very specific community and sort of leaning on their trust because of the shared connection that you have.
Oh, we had that in, oh gosh, the 13, no. What is it when they fake a pandemic? Oddly fitting for right now. Because and he was Armenian and he swindled the Armenian guy out of his money because they're both like, you know, have the same heritage.
Yes, and actually,
I shot him in the courthouse.
It happened, and it's funny. I didn't remember they did an episode like that because that has happened more than once in the Armenian community, sadly. And there are, of course, other. You know, they could be cultural, they could be ethnic, they could be religious. Anywhere where you have sort of an automatic in because you share this affinity for whatever it is. Enables you to do that kind of thing. And fraud is, of course, ugly in general, but there's something particularly really, to me at least, icky about affinity fraud because it's just, you know, it's a betrayal of so much trust. And
how is that person going to trust anybody in their community again?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
And
that's breaking not just the trust between two people, but between a person and something that they identify strongly with.
Yeah. Their own culture, whatever, you know, or a piece of their culture, whatever that might mean. And so anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on to the actual episode, as opposed to the episode that it isn't.
The way that we would have written it.
Yes.
I also love that she kind of badmouths Grifter. She's like, this Grifter or this con artist, they're the worst people in the world. And Sophie's like, well, pop the brakes.
Let's talk about art.
Our victims don't really know the background of the team that they're, you know, asking to help them. They only know them as good guys. And I just, you know, Sophie's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
First of all, let's not call this guy what he does. This is not grifting. Grifting is beautiful.
Yes.
Grifting is elegant.
Back up the truck.
This is a parody.
Yes. This is just brutal fraud. Yeah.
Yeah. And Nate has to like put his hand on her thigh and be like, just chill out, girl. Yep. And she's like, ooh, he's touching me. And then... then we go right into our presentation with Elliot asking where Parker is. Like, are we going to wait for Parker to start? And we find out that we're not waiting on her because she's at a chocolate convention.
Hopped up on chocolate, yeah.
Hopped up on chocolate. Sophie is utterly delighted by, one, that she's there having a good time, and two, that Hardison is so, like, annoyed. But he's not annoyed that she's, I mean, he's like, this is not safe. It's like sending a crack addict to a cocaine festival, but he's more upset that she's misspelled words in her text and probably gotten chocolate all over the keys on her phone.
Right.
These are where his priorities lie.
Of course.
But Sophie's just delighted. She's like, that's so great.
Yes.
And Nate is just wearing a hoodie, which I thought was very strange, except later the hoodie comes back in like a subtle way that I think is interesting. And I was just like, why is he so dressed down? What is he wearing?
Well, Nate has two modes, really. He's got, you know, dressed like a schlubby normal person, or like, what the fuck is he wearing? I'm sorry. I can't remember if we're allowed to swear on this one or not.
Oh, I do it all the time. It's fine.
Because like later on, I noted, you know, like oftentimes, you know, later on I noted, what, you know, like he's wearing a hat and he's got a cane. You know, like sometimes there's a scarf too. It's
He had an ascot.
Yeah. It's like, dude, you are parodying, you know, Scrooge McDuck.
I think he was. The only way that he wasn't was that it was not a top hat that he was wearing. So, yeah, I guess I'm just used to him when he's dressed like a schlub, he's also drunk.
Yeah.
And here he's not drunk, like his shirt is clean, his hoodie is clean. It seems weird that he's not wearing a button down, but not really the end of the world. It's just something that I was like, okay. And we kind of get some background on Greg Sherman. He's a direct descendant of the Yellow Kid, who was possibly the greatest con man of all time. And Elliot doesn't know about this, so he gets to be like who we explain things to.
Right.
And that's because Elliot doesn't care about cons. He'll just beat you up until you give him the thing that he needs.
Right.
And they say like between 1900 and 1940, he swindled people out of nearly $10 million in like current.
Right.
You adjust for inflation, that's like a gazillion dollars, Hardison says. And we will find out more about the Yellow Kid in my high slight because I'm excited to talk about the Yellow Kid. He's a real person, y'all.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm just going to look at, oh my God. Several of the other con men that he mentions Sherman mentions later are also real.
Right.
But we're going to talk about the Yellow Kid for sure.
The word Ponzi scheme refers to a real person too, right?
Yes. I knew that, but I haven't done any research on that person.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to, because this isn't a Ponzi scheme. So
But whenever that comes up.
Yeah.
So we find out that Hardison knows people who've like worked with him or know about him, and that he's runs his scams without scruples, and he's basically the worst. Yep. And the scam he's invented is an inverted pyramid scheme. So if you think a pyramid scheme is bad, and it is, an inverted pyramid scheme can definitely not be good. But Elliot does know about these. So you call, and this is where you might have to help me. Sure. You call 20 people. And you tell 10 of them that a stock is going to go up, and you tell the other 10 that it's going to go down. Mm-hmm. And then whichever one is right, you call those 10 people back and you do it over again.
Yep.
And by doing this, you can convince people that you can predict how the market's going to go.
Right.
So that kind of makes sense to me.
And they are also talking to some of them are talking to their friends. And so they are self-perpetuating the scheme. In a way that does not require any effort on your part as well. There's sort of like a before things were viral, this is sort of a virality concept.
Okay. So then those friends that your 10 people told about, they're going to come to you to invest their money.
Yep.
Okay. I was like, then how do you get the money? I don't understand. Okay. Now I think I get it. But Hardison says he's not calling 20 people. In every city that he sets up this scam, he sets up a boiler room, and they're calling 1,000 people at a time.
Yep.
So they've like increased their profit by like a big old number.
Yes.
I don't know how many percent, but a bunch of percents. And so the big problem with this guy is that he is basically grifter royalty, and he's going to know every single grift that they or con that they try to pull on him.
Right.
And then my favorite trope in Leverage, we get to have an argument over different cons are.
Yes.
Without knowing anything about them.
Ludicrous names for them. I haven't heard the Peruvian slide, which needs two old people and a banana peel.
And so he's like, no, that's the Boca Backlash or something. Right. And then there's one that has to do with like a Rottweiler and fireworks. And I'm just like, I want to be in the writer's room when they were coming up with these things.
There's two niche jobs I've wanted in my entire life that aren't actually probably jobs. They're just the parts of somebody else's job, but I want to make them a full-time job. I want to name OPI nail polish.
Yes.
And I want to invent con names for a show like Leverage.
There we go. And I feel like, what if you were like a freelance person and you did that, those two jobs, and then you also like named paint samples?
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody out there is doing it. And if, lovely listeners, if you know how we can get into this job.
Yeah.
Adele would like to do this on the side.
We have two librarians who want this gig bad.
I would love that. I'm a millennial, so side gigs are my jam.
Your hustle, yeah.
I love it. All right.
Position X, and we just kind of go, yeah, maybe. That sounds like fun. I don't see how to make it into a career.
I'll help you. It's fine. We hear about all these cons, but he's going to know about them. And Nate says, you can't con a con artist. So what we're going to do is we're just going to straight up steal from him, which seems really simple. And you know, that's not how it's going to work out, because
of course not.
Leverage is never that simple. And especially this season, they like split from like doing like a 3-act episode to like a 5-act episode. So there's going to be like several switches, which I like that they really leveled up their game in this season.
Yep.
So Hardison's going in to pose as one of Sherman's employees, the only guy of color in the room.
Yes.
But still a guy.
Still a guy, yes.
And we hear Sherman call himself the Mako as he paces back and forth in front of them in a very shark-like manner.
I'm at the top of the food chain and every mark is a meal.
Reminds me of the, have you seen the musical, Legally Blonde, the musical?
I have not. I've seen the movie, but I haven't.
The musical is better.
Ooh.
The movie is amazing. The whole musical is, they filmed it for, and put it on MTV back in the early aughts, and it's all on YouTube. So if you want to watch the entire musical, it's on YouTube. It's amazing. But when you meet the lawyer professor, the bad guy whose name I can't think of, played by Victor Garber in the movie.
Yes.
He has a whole song about like how, you know, when you start your law career, there's a joke you're bound to hear. Every lawyer is a shark, but ignore it. That's simplistic and it's wrong. Just some of you are sharks, just some, the rest are chum. And so the whole song is like about being like about blood in the water and being a shark.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm just like, da, 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 da. Like just singing this whenever he's talking about being a freaking shark. Like, you wish you were a shark, you dumb man. Hardison's also been really upping his game on like playing different characters. Mm-hmm. And it helps that he's got Sophie in his ear right now, because she's like, all right, you know, keep your, like, don't look away, but keep your eyes soft. Like, he's
right.
Really, really good at reading people, and he's like weeding out the weak, and you've got to stay. So we know from here, like, he knows he can clock people, you know, at 500 paces. So he's,
and not only that, he's playing dominance games, and I think part of her advice was about not having Hardison challenge him too much, and sort of letting him be the alpha dog.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. And then we have Hardison proving his worth as a swindler here, and he like talks to a Mr. Kalupny and takes all of his money. But then as soon as Sherman walks away, he like reverses the charge. It's like, look, you made your money back. And now Parker is back from the chocolate convention, and she's all hopped up, even more hyper than normal. And Hardison checks in. He's like by himself in the boiler room. And we find out that he's not able to find where exactly Sherman's storing all of his money, probably like somewhere like Timor, I think he says. And so they've got to make him move his private funds so that they can get to them, so they can steal them. And Parker's just wants to know what the name of the job is. She's like, what are we stealing? Is it a mountain? Is it a funeral? What are we doing? I need to know. And they're just like, shut up.
All the while she's drumming chocolate bars on a table.
And she's got like smears of chocolate on her white shirt. She's like, I couldn't stop drinking this white chocolate mocha cappuccino espresso thing.
Oh dear.
Sophie's just like, I am no longer delighted. And while they're talking, Sherman comes in with his flunky, and
his flunky of Hidden Depths, we find out later.
Yes, who is also not credited in the IMDb. I'm like, I probably should just look it up in the credits for on the DVDs, because I love this guy. He looks like what's his name? Elias or Elias Codius from Some Kind of Wonderful. He looks like the thug.
Like
the guy that Eric Stoltz is in detention with.
I have seen that movie literally once.
Oh, okay. It's my favorite movie.
As we know from the first episode of this season, I love Eric Stoltz, but that particular movie I did not consider really worth rewatching.
Oh, I love that movie. Okay, who doesn't love talking about John Hughes? Anyways, Sherman comes in. Oh, yeah, and it was my fault that we got off on this, because this flunky with Hidden Depths.
Yes.
Who also, like, I believe grows a mustache during the course of this episode. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have one in this scene, but in the last scene, he has a Fu Manchu.
Interesting. So dude probably had another role coming up.
No, and I'm like, how many days did they shoot this over? He's bald. Like, how fast does this man grow hair?
Oh, if he, I mean, I'm, you know, we're 1 month into pandemic land, and I've already trimmed my bangs once. So
Fu Manchu. He knows. So Sherman knows who Hardison is, and
made. The Mako makes him.
Yeah. So they have to, like, just roll with this. And he's like, so what are you doing? And Nate says, you know, tell him that he was hired to park proxies in his account by a commodities mogul. I know these are words. What the heck is a proxy in regards to this? Do you know?
Oh, honestly, no. This is a little involved for my level of both either knowledge or remembrance, because it's been over 10 years since I've worked in this field. Because if I'm remembering correctly, I mean, proxies can mean several different things with regards to trading. And so what it would have meant to me is, I think, not what it would mean to this guy. Because like I said, I dealt exclusively in equities, which is shares of companies. If you're talking about futures, you are talking about commodities, not companies. So commodities are things like oranges or bacon, or, you know, so they're products that are kind of very fungible.
Yeah, that many companies will sell.
It's not that necessarily that companies will sell. They sell on commodities markets.
Okay.
So yes, they are bought and sold by companies, but they're also, the trading gets sort of centralized, for lack of a better term, into specific markets where they basically bet on, like, how good the yield is going to be. And so if they think the yield is going to be very good, the price is lower because there will be more supply with probably about a steady demand. Okay. And vice versa, which is why crop reports are important. And getting an inside look at a crop report before it comes out, especially if it's a surprise, allows you to make a play, an investment play. So if the crop report is going to be exceedingly good and it's expected to be bad, you could short that commodity, basically bet that it is going to, I hope I'm getting this right. I'm really flying by the seat of my pants here, but basically it allows you to put your money in such a way so that you will get guaranteed to make money.
Okay.
Because the idea is that one of the biggest, most important things in trading of any kind of commodities or stocks or anything else is information. And the reason why insider trading is bad is that if you are trading on information that is important but not widely known, that is unfair.
Okay.
And so trading laws and regulations are mostly geared towards attempting to make that playing field as level as possible, the informational playing field, so that everybody knows the same thing at the same time.
Okay.
At least about important stuff. So in a case of a company, that would be, say, their earnings reports or their supply chain, their ability to produce things that matter and that they can sell for money, mm-hmm. and make their earnings projections. In terms of commodities, it's things like crop reports or yield reports or things like that.
Okay.
So if you get an advance information about that, you can stand to make a lot of money, especially if the report is a surprise, either way.
Okay. It's different than what people are going to expect it to be.
Exactly. Okay. Because if people expect, for instance, a good yield for whatever commodity it is, chocolate, they expect the price is going to be very low. If you get a report in advance that says that the yield is going to be much lower than expected, you know that price for that commodity is going to probably go up.
So you're going to buy it now while it's lower.
Exactly.
And it once it gets high and make a lot of profit.
Exactly. Okay. And you could do the opposite for the opposite scenario. You would short it, which is basically you sell it before you own it. You basically promise to buy it later.
Okay.
But functionally what you're doing is you're selling it now, even though you don't own it yet. I know. It's weird. It's weird.
Oh,
listeners, C is giving me such a look, but I swear to God, this is a thing.
Like, not only does it like not make sense to me, but it also seems horrible to do.
It's betting that something is going to, is something that something wrong, bad is going to happen. Yeah. But the thing about trading of any kind is that it is not about buying and selling per se. It's about making money. And there are a lot of different vehicles to do that within markets. And yeah, she's shaking her head and I'm like, yeah, I was in these trenches for a dozen years and yeah, it's a wild ride, let me tell you.
Oh, that sounds so horrible. I don't like it. But here we are about to jump more into this episode about it.
So sorry, little securities information there. So.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's going to build a foundation for us to understand what the rest of the episode's about.
Well, I hope it's comprehensible because, oh my God.
I sort of got it. In like 5 minutes, I will have forgotten everything and I'll just pretend that I know what's happening.
Not necessary for most people's daily knowledge. It's just not.
Right? Right? I don't need to keep that. So Hardison tells him that he's working for a commodities mogul who is known as Count Chocula because he only buys chocolate commodities.
Yep.
And Nate's like, Count Chocula, really, really, Hardison? Which I think is great, like Hardison, like off the cuff doing this because yep. He is already knowing that the best way to, like, as we were saying earlier, to get under Sherman's skin is to like make fun of his name. And he's like, Count Chocula, that's a dumb name. He's like, well, yeah, it's a dumb name. It's what other people call him. Like, he didn't come up with his nickname. He's not one of those idiots who makes up their own nicknames.
Yeah.
And the Mako's like, But he immediately wants to meet this guy. And so they've got to right away get an office.
Yep.
And like fake some credentials.
Shades of the pilot, really.
Yeah. It's been, like get the people outside. It's just, yeah, so good. And Elliot gets to wear his favorite, you know, Coke bottle glasses and pretend to be a bumbling janitor. Do you want to help?
Oh, you're right.
Nate and Sophie pretend they're from the IRS and from like the British equivalent.
Loined.
Like, she's the comptroller. And yeah, he's like, my name's Loined. Like Loined with a D.
D.
And then he messes up like the idiom of across the pond.
Yes.
Which is just like fun little like nitpicking character beats.
Yes.
And then they go to change and we see Nate walks in when Sophie's in the middle of changing and she's got this like really nice like negligee on under her dress and he's like,
you look about her wearing a cocktail dress during the day.
Yeah. I guess it's because she's supposed to go to that event later.
Yes.
Also like that it's like a champagne colored cocktail dress.
Satin for chocolate convention.
Like
it's satin. It's sorry, we were just singing the praises of the costumer and now we're going, wait, what?
I know. But I choose to believe that it all suits later on.
And that's fair. You know? I kind of did the same thing, but my notes are like, satin in the daytime?
And she also has like a fascinator on. So, you know, she's not really.
Maybe she's heading for Ascot.
Perhaps she's a royal wedding to attend in a moment,
right?
And yeah, but she's got some like, you know, nice negligee and Nate's like, oh, you look great in that. She's like, why are you so surprised you picked it out? And you know, they have like a little moment and Elliot comes barging in when he's like zipping up her dress, and he's not like, hey, what are you guys doing? But you can see like a moment of him being like, you're sitting awfully close together and very comfortable about it. But we don't have time because he's here.
It's very, it's kind of icky when mom and dad get, you know.
You're like, no. Just me, cover my eyes.
Yeah.
When Sherman gets there with Hardison, Elliot does his janitor routine and he's just like, oh, sorry, I'm in your way. Oh, still in your way. And Sherman starts to walk away and then he's like, wait. And he goes and he like rifles through the cart. I don't know what he's looking for, but he's so suspicious. So weird. I don't know why. But yeah, Nate has, by this point, like, done his whole costume change, and he's got the just, like, quintessential, like, over-the-top stockbroker kind of look, but the white cuffs and the white collar, and ascot, pinstripes, the hat, because Nate loves the hat.
Cane.
We haven't seen it yet, but he does have a cane. And he's like pissed that Hardison has brought this guy to him. He's like, you got to get him out of here. She's on her way. And then we see Sophie. Well, he doesn't want to talk to Sherman at all. He's like, I can park my proxies anywhere. So I guess they're hiding the proxies on other people's servers? Spread them out?
The specifics of the scheme do elude me, I have to say. I should have done some research, but you know, basically I think what he's looking for is additional money for his scheme.
Okay. I sort of get that. So he like hustles Hardison and Sherman out when we see Sophie waiting down in the lobby. And that's when I noticed the shark teeth in the pocket square.
Yep.
And, you know, Sherman's like, who's she? And Hardison's like, that's the chocolate whisperer? Where have you been? Uh-huh. yeah. So, you know, Sherman's intrigued. So he starts following Sophie and he follows her to the chocolate festival where they've put her on the lineup and she's going to be like having a chocolate tasting competition with another chocolate expert. And this is where this episode makes me sad because I don't know who was going to compete against Laverne before, but she goes up against Laverne, who has a book about chocolate called Dark Orgasms.
Orgasms, I know.
And they were like, I don't know, we were so afraid we wouldn't get it past the network with that title, but they did somehow. It's about her love affair with chocolate.
You know, I think at this point that the network had kind of stopped giving them notes. From what I can recall I tried to see if there was a Kung Fu Monkey blog post about this episode, and I don't think there was. I think at that point, John Rogers was just too busy. And he was only sort of sporadically doing his Q&As, which is we all know I so adored. I love the inside baseball of all of these. I think that the network was just kind of like, you guys are killing it. Go.
You're doing fine. Keep going. Yeah. Whatever you think will work. So she's got to win this contest, and Sherman, and we get to see again how Sherman is really, really good at his job. He and his flunky pick Parker's purse.
Nope.
And steal her phone, which Nate wants to happen, but Parker, even though she probably knows it needed to happen.
Professional pride is so piqued by this.
She cannot. And they're definitely not as good as Parker, because they needed two people and an umbrella to do this. Mm-hmm. And Parker's just like, it's just me and a box of chocolate, when she goes and lifts his wallet, his phone, and on my third watch, I realized his watch as well.
Yes, yes.
Which is why, like, Nate makes her put them back, but she steals his credit card first.
Yes,
we do. When right after she like puts everything back, he goes to grab like a little cup of chocolate from a waitress, and he like adjusts his arm. I was like, why is he taking so long to pick up this cup? We don't have time. Come on. Oh, it's so we can see that his watch is perfectly back on his wrist. Okay, I got it. Sorry. Yes. Sorry, Arvin Brown. I did not mean to misjudge you. Then we see Sophie go up against Laverne, the chocolate expert, and Hardison's stressing out because he's like, I've got all the info on all the beans, but I don't know which one they're going to eat. And Nate's like, oh, she's got this. And he's like, Sophie, it's just like Belgium in 99. You got this. You're good. And she's just like, yeah, sure, I have this. So we know she's infiltrated the world of chocolate before, which I love.
Well, the economy of the script work for that too is just like, takes what, like 2-3 lines to establish that she has this history and that she's good, and just let her roll with it.
Well, it's like 3 words, Belgium in 99.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now we can infer a history of her doing this.
Right.
And she's so much better than this woman, even though she hasn't done this in, you know, several years.
12 years.
10 years. 12 years. And immediately after this, poor Laverne is over in the corner, like, hugging her book and in tears, basically. And she and Parker, like, blow off Greg, because he's trying to talk to them. She's like, oh, sorry, Craig, she can't talk right now. And she walks over, and she has this chat with these two Chinese business people. And this is when we find out that the flunky has hidden depths.
Yes. It's Chinese. We should have had Lisa on this.
Just amazing. Yeah, he's like, translate. And he's like, oh, okay. And he goes through. And then he even like adds little things like, your dress is very nice.
Nice dress. Like, I don't care about that. Important things.
And we find out that the chocolate whisperer, Sophie's character, is going to open up a chain of like basically chocolate Starbucks. Russian cafes, chocolate cafes in China. And that's why Count Chocula is buying all of these chocolate futures.
Yes.
Because he knows that there's going to be a big run on chocolate and he'll make a killing.
Right.
So then they go and they be bad guys and they knock Nate out as he's coming out of the office building, and they bring him back to the boiler room and they have him all tied up, and he still has his hat on.
Yes, he does.
Out, his hat stays on. And Elliot is down in the stairwell, and Sophie's like, Elliot's in place. He can come in at any time. And Elliot's like, I am ready to come tear their lungs out. Very specific, and I love it. And also, okay, this is when I wanted to bring back Nate wearing his hoodie earlier, because now Sophie's still in her cocktail dress, but she is wearing Nate's hoodie on top of it.
Ah, okay. Nice cut.
Which is kind of hinting at like their intimacy that the other characters don't know about yet.
Hinting? Screaming?
Yeah. Well, in a second, because they don't realize it until in just a second, because Sherman tells Nate that he doesn't believe his con,
right.
Because the money that he would make the money that is spent on chocolate in China is way less than the money that's spent in Switzerland. on chocolate. So he's like, obviously there's something else that you are doing,
right,
that you know is going to make more money. And, you know, maybe the chocolate whisperer is in on it. Nate's like, no, no, she's legitimate. And he was like, oh, why? Because you're sleeping with her. everybody watching the show is like, oh!
And the rest of the team is going, not mom and dad. No, they never had sex.
What? Sophie's like, oh, he's just trying to rattle Nate. And Parker's like, you said he was the best at this that you've ever seen. So, oh, crap. Yeah, she's like, we don't have time to talk about this right now. Nate is, you know, trying to deflect away from that. And he's like, well, I know a guy who knows things. And when this thing that he knows comes out, then that's when I'm going to announce China. And that's when I'm going to make all this money. So yeah, and then I guess they let him go. They're like, okay, cool. Because I guess he's like, well, I'm going to buy you a ticket to Ecuador, so let me go. And Nate's back at the bar, and Sophie's putting ice on his head, yep. But he still has his hat on.
Always. He has the unfortunate haircut and the hat. That's...
Yeah, I was like, is this like a Matilda moment? Did someone glue his hat brim to his head? I don't understand. So Parker wants to know, like, Nate and Sophie didn't tell them they're having this relationship. But Sophie's like, we don't have time for this. Like, let's focus, because this guy is our hardest mark that we've ever had to deal with.
Right.
And,
stole a freaking country, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Yeah. And this guy's difficult. So mm-hmm. That's bad. So, you know, they're saying he's too clever. And he knows everybody else in the business. So there's no one that they can call in to help.
Right.
Like, if they called in Tara, he probably knows who Tara is, you know.
Right.
Not that they can't call in Parker's, what's his name?
Archie. Because,
yeah, Archie. Can't call in Archie or anybody else that we know. Yep. Because he'd see right through that. So that's why they're going to use civilians.
Yeah.
Which I think just the minute you say civilians, you're like, no, what? No.
I've heard civilians underlined. That's it. That's the one note for that.
Like, I'm already stressed. Like, yeah, civilians, right? They can't do this. So, you know, and they've got to keep him off balance and push him out of his comfort zone. They're like, well, how far are we gonna push him? We're gonna push him right into the jungles of Ecuador.
Right.
Or a nursery in Portland, Oregon, which is where they filmed that scene.
Of course they did. Well, and my note for that is, Menacing Elliot is the best Elliot.
Menacing Elliot with like eyeliner.
Oh yeah.
In like the Indiana Jones getup.
And an Indiana Jones hat and a machete.
Yes. It's so good.
Yeah.
So good. They told him, I think the acting notes they gave him, that he was like, how do you want me to play this? And they were like, play it like you want to kiss him, but you can't.
I freaking love it.
Like, all right. So like, there are parts where he's like, are you making fun of me? And he just like gets really close. And then he kills the snake and he eats the snake's heart.
And that's a Romancing the Stone callback, because there is a scene in Romancing the Stone.
Okay. Yeah. All right, well, let's keep going so I can go watch.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, so while they're in the jungle, Parker is using the flunky's credit card to buy a bunch of monitors and stuff.
Yes.
For them to set up their big store.
Yes.
And Hardison's doing something, but we don't really know what. And we find out he's going to have to go remote. Like, he's going to have to go to a location and out of the apartment, but we don't know why. And Elliot is showing Sherman that the Ecuadorian government is...
Eco-terrorism!
Yes. Is deforesting large areas of the rainforest, which is going to affect the chocolate crops. But they are doing it secretly, so the companies don't know. So they're going to say, oh, chocolate's going to be fine, but it's not.
Our whole discussion about crop reports and expectations, yeah, and how people park their money and how that works, yes.
And that's how Nate's going to make so much money, right? They said, obviously, they didn't set up a scene of deforesting a rainforest. Portland lets them do a lot of things, but I don't think this is one of them.
That's stock footage.
It's stock footage from, like, you know, a documentary or something. And they're like, thank you, you documentary filmmakers who thought you were going to have this big impact. We used it for our television show.
Yes.
So then Sherman is back. Also, I love that he's in this suit in the jungle. And he's just like sweating and it's raining. He's like,
hair is plastered to his head, but his little shark tooth pocket square is still awful perky.
That thing is starched to hell.
Yeah, right. I think it might be like there might be hemming tape, like just like
sew it down,
adhered to the suit.
Just glued on. So back in the States, Sherman has taken this info and he runs with it. So he's having guys go long on timber because that's what they're cutting down. Right. And also he's flooding the social media with this information.
Right.
But he doesn't say exactly what information here. He's like, just flood, keep going with the flood, social media. And then I guess he talks about it in a little bit. So we're like, oh, he's going to tell people that this is happening and he's going to make a lot of money from the trees. And then we find out that Hardison has found his way into the business accounts, but not yet into his personal accounts. What got him move money?
To back up a little bit, what he would be doing on social media or any other kind of media back then, it probably would have been the Yahoo stock chat forums were huge back in the day. I don't know if they were still huge in 2011, but I know when I was working in this area, they were the bane of my existence. And they could move markets. And what would happen is he would not be flooding the whichever form it would have been with information, the information he'd learned. It would be the opposite. So if he was investing in timber, mm-hmm. he'd want to keep the price low while he invested.
Okay.
So he would be flooding the information channels with information that indicated that timber was weak.
Mm.
And that would keep the price artificially low while he bought. And then when the news came out that, you know, timber was strong.
Okay. Then he'd
actually vice versa. He would actually probably have been shorting, but that's neither here nor there. But he would.
But I understood.
the thing about markets is that if you know something before someone else, first of all, you shouldn't be trading on that information because in many cases it's illegal. In some cases, that's actually not, which is unfortunate. But
if you're a congressperson, you definitely shouldn't be doing
that. Well, there is the Stock Act, which makes many of these kinds of trades illegal, but that's a whole other story. Having insider information often depends on what kind of an insider you are. So if you discover information through your own, like not through an insider connection, it's very hard, I think, to prosecute those cases. I'm not 100% up to date on this, but I know historically that was the case. At any rate, it's a dicey area. It's a super dicey area. But if you are trading on information, however you're placing your money, you're going to want the rest of the world to either remain in ignorance or think
the opposite of whatever you know.
Exactly. Okay. Even more so.
Okay. Okay.
I really hope I'm not coming across as ridiculously incoherent on this topic because, like I said, it's been a long time since I've thought about it.
It's okay. We'll be fine. So
none of this is legal advice.
Oh, I know. Maybe we should make like a thing ahead of time. Be like, don't follow any of our advice. Don't short stocks, people. But yeah, so we still need to get to his personal accounts because that's where the big money is. If he's going to want to go to the big store, he's going to have to move some of that though. So Nate's like, it'll be fine. But Sophie is not sure. And she even says, like, he's been doing this for longer than I have. Like, he's going to probably see through this. Mm-hmm. But Nate's like, it's going to be fine. And Sherman calls Nate after he's just said, I can't wait to make this call. And he tells him that he's in. And Nate tells him he has to bring $10 million in cash the next day at their big store. So then there's so many amazing, like, I feel like quintessential leverage scenes in this episode, because we've got Elliot in the jungle, we get the chocolate convention, and then we get this, where all of these, like, normal people are learning how to pretend to be stock traders, and they're, like, running around, and they're so stressed out about trying to get them to hit their marks and pretend to be what they're not. And these people are just like, where's the bear?
Yeah. But what if the bear eats me?
Yes. Oh, Mrs. Cox with an X. So great. So they're talking about intentional blindness, which is, they want him to be so focused on everything else that he doesn't notice the moonwalking bear.
Right.
Which bears, like, that happens.
Yeah.
It's a real, real phenomenon.
Well, there's at least one YouTube video where the instruction is follow the basketball as it is passed among the various players. And there's a few, like, people in a circle, and they're passing a basketball. And then at the end of it, it's like, at what point did the gorilla, the person in the gorilla costume, move through the scene? And you're like,
yeah.
What gorilla? What
gorilla? I was watching the basketball.
And then you watch it again when you're not watching the basketball, and there's this friggin' person in a gorilla costume that literally waltzes through the middle of everything, and you do not see it.
Yeah.
You're so focused on that basketball being passed around.
I wonder, for, like, people with ADD who can't focus on things really well, I wonder if they are fooled by that.
I don't know.
But also, people with ADD tend to hyper-focus when they can. So they'll hyper-focus on one thing. So they're probably just like us. But yeah, so I just, they're also funny. Sophie's interaction with a man that we only know as Nugget, because he was an Equus. She's like, oh, you have acted. And
he's like, I was the front
of the horse.
For those of you who have actually ever seen a red Equus, the horse does not actually make an appearance in the play. It's only...
Oh, I didn't even realize that. That's so funny.
Reference.
That's so great. So yeah, and then he's just called Nugget the rest of the time, which, I don't know if that... No, it's probably not at all, but it works in well with what I'll talk about with the high slate at the end. But, Nate is very stressed, but he also looks like he's having a lot of fun, like, bossing around tons of people. And Sophie, you would think, would be really excited, but she's really just got jitters. Well, and
she's being a director.
Yes.
And she's like a dance. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. It's like, honey, these people can't dance. So let's...
And Nugget's like, what's my motivation for going through the room? She's like, to get to the other side. It's like a really bad chicken cross the road joke.
Well, there's that, and then there's also the very famous incident where Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire asked the director in one particular scene, what's my motivation? And the director had so had it with Brando, he said, your paycheck.
That's great.
So yeah, the question, what's my motivation for an actor who, like, knows the history of acting is sort of like, don't go there.
you make that up. It's all in your head. Like, you figure that out on your own.
Well, it's your job.
Yeah.
As an actor, that's your job. It's like, you figure that out. That's what you do.
And that's why Nugget has only been the front part of a horse that wasn't actually in the play.
Exactly.
And then wherever Hardison is, he's very exhausted and he's literally sick of orange soda. So, you know, he's been working really hard, whatever he is doing.
As with, you know, one who's tired of London is tired of life, when Hardison's tired of orange soda, you know, things have gone to hell.
Yeah. And then Sherman's there. Parker again gets his name wrong and calls him Mr. Sherlock.
Yes.
Which is just so great. And then this is when I notice that the flunky now like appears to have a Fu Manchu. But it's also really the, no, we, I was like, it's not the first time we see him in daylight.
No.
I swear he didn't have one earlier. I'll have to go back and watch it again. But I swear he did not have facial hair earlier. And, you know, he comes in and Nate's like, all right, you gotta, Greg, you gotta give me your money. Or he calls him the maker or something. He gets him, I don't know, Sharky, I don't know. And he's like, oh, I've got everything for you in this case right here. But the case is empty. And he does his big gloat about how he knew the whole time that they were conning him. Like, he's not dumb. Like, I thought it was really great how you flew me to Ecuador. And he's like, this guy right here, he was hilarious.
It's a full villain speech.
Oh, yeah. And everybody's sitting around, he's like making fun of their tells. And he's like, this guy messed up his line. They're wearing trading jackets.
And the reason, and part of the reason why he's saying is it's dated. And I haven't actually been on a literal trading floor in a very long time, but electronic trading has never used trading jackets as far as I know. That's only for floor-based, like New York Stock Exchange, where like the people are literally shouting at each other because you recognize the person and the gold jacket is with a particular firm. Mm. That's why they would wear those ugly jackets, is so that it would mark them out as like, okay,
yeah,
you know, this many shares, you're buying at X.
I'm just remembering that scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off when they're like at the stock exchange and they're like standing up there watching, and I'm like, oh God, it gives me a migraine.
Oh yeah. 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 I worked for a stock market that never did that. That was, it was all electronic trading with screens, which is what they're doing here. So it makes no sense to have trading jackets at all. I don't know why they had a reference to the date. It's more about, this is not that's not that kind of floor.
Yeah. I mean, for us, we understand in a minute why they're wearing those. Mm-hmm. Because it's part of the dancing bear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another thing to distract him. Like, look at these amateurs.
Yeah. Focus on this.
How cool am I? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Nate's like, okay, fine. You caught us, but you know what? You didn't make any money, so it's fine. And he's like, well, actually, I did what you were going to do. I flooded the market with the rumors about this chocolate Starbucks thing. And chocolate prices are going to soar. And I committed over $30 million in cocoa futures. And then by the time the rumors are found out not to be true, I'm going to be off in a country with no extradition and they won't be able to do anything about it.
Right. He will have sold his locked in his gains by selling and skedaddled.
Yeah. And he's like so proud of himself because this is the biggest con ever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now he's finally going to be like up in the upper echelons with his forebears. You know, Nate's like, cool, but you were so focused on the con that we got you anyways, because you forgot about our plan A, which was Hardison's cyber heist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as they're explaining this to him, the FBI raids the boiler room, and Mick Sweetin is there.
Of course he is.
Getting his win for doing no work again.
Yep.
Well, he had done a lot of work because he was like right on his heels before.
Yeah.
So he's been doing some good stuff. And he charges him with 47 counts of fraud and market manipulation and other things that I forgot as soon as he said them and didn't want to rewind back. And the flunky like tries to make a run for it. He's like, well, no, I'm out of here.
Can't get through Elliot.
Yeah. He like pushes Elliot and tries to punch him. And Elliot's like, oh, thank you so much. I haven't hit anybody in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Jones in.
Bam, kabam, kabam.
Yes. And then like brushes his hair back and smiles at the pretty lady next to him.
Yeah.
That's like a bingo.
Yeah. It's like, how you doing?
Hat trick for Elliot. And Sherman's like, well, who are all these people? These aren't shills. Who are these people? And we find out that they're all of his victims.
Right.
I say this every episode because there's something that I always miss. There's a reason I watch it three times, because the second time I was like, why is he showing off the wangs? Like, Mr. and Miss the Wangs, who, like, you screwed their father out of money, is because they're the Chinese couple that Sophie talks to at the chocolate convention. Because on this watch through, I, like, paused it, and I went to the bathroom, and I was like, who are those people that she was talking to? Like, are there some business people in China who think that this woman's going to start a chocolate Starbucks with them? What's happening? And I'm like, oh, no, that's why we saw them again at the end, because they were in on it the whole time.
They were not just on the trading floor. They also participated earlier because they're better actors than Nugget.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see Sheila's there as well. Just super good. Oh, Agent Bob comes in and he's like, hey, are you a special agent?
Passes her a note.
Passes her not just a note, but a haiku from McSweden. And she's like, cool, tell him hi. Which further incenses?
Mm-hmm.
Sherman, who's like, FBI, no, they're con artists.
Yes.
He's like, yeah, sure, we're all con artists, Mr. Oh, Lindsay.
And we've got Parker behind Bob, you know, totally gaslighting, like, are you crazy, dude? What's wrong with you?
I love it. I love when they do that so much. And yeah. Everybody's like, what's his nickname again? Like, McSweeten is like, what do I call him? And Hardison says, oh, I think it's the Blowfish. Yes. And then everybody's like, Lamprey. And like, oh, my favorite is Sophie. Gefilte fish.
Gefilte fish, yes.
Gefilte fish.
Yes.
So good. And then they have, like, the party at the end where, you know, we get to see the victim reunited with their money. And not only did she get her $72,000 back, but now there's over $1 million in her bank account, which is really sweet.
She baked them.
Yes. She made them a cake.
Of course she did.
That's so nice. And it's just like one layer. It's really small.
Sad little cake, but she made it for them.
And I love it. And all of the other victims are like, they're all having a party.
Yeah.
And I just, that's so sweet. And then we get to have a conversation about the pink Argyle elephant in the room, about mom and dad dating each other.
Yeah.
But Sophie is very quick to say this is not a relationship. This is just friends with Bennies, as Hardison says.
Yeah.
And then they all get distracted by Nugget and Mrs. Cox slow dancing.
Yes.
Very, very awkwardly. But they're so happy. And they're like, that's both adorable and weird.
Well, that's the thing that this show often does with us, you know, secondary and tertiary characters, is that they will have these, like, little mini happily ever after things that just kind of they're just there.
Yeah.
You know, not necessary for the story, but it's just, it shows that that writer's room has a lot of heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I mean, I'm thinking back to when I brought back the guy from the addiction episode.
12-step job.
Yeah, the 12-step job. And then
he comes back soon, Hurley.
Yeah, Hurley.
Yeah,
that was total fan service. I mean,
yeah,
the fans loved that character. And, you know, and he was great. He was so, so wonderful. And they not only gave him, you know, another, you know, two episodes, they gave him a hot girlfriend.
Right. We should all be so lucky. Yeah, they mentioned that a lot in the commentary whenever they're kind of gushing about the villains. So, like, mm-hmm. It kind of sucks that we have to destroy our bad guys because then you can't bring them back. Like,
right.
I mean, sometimes they can.
They do.
It does happen several times in this season alone.
Yes.
But for the most part, you destroy them, they go to jail. You know, they are paying for their crimes and you can't have them back even though they were so magnetic and they were so great and they were so compelling.
And then they did an entire season which basically brought them back, so right? Hey.
Yes. So I guess they were like, you know what, we're sick of that, we're gonna find a way around it.
Yes, these guys would have teamed up.
Yeah. And speaking of old villains,
yes,
we find out because you think the episode's over because it always ends on like a cute little note. Mm-hmm. But no, Hardison comes in and tells Nate that he has found out who's been bugging them. Yeah. It's a man named Jack Latimer, who Hardison found through his interests in Verdagra. And Nate says, that's the potato job, but we found the listening device before that. And he's like, and he names a couple of the other industries that investments that he's, you know, had interest in. And he's like, oh, so he's lost money because of the jobs that we've done. So he's out for revenge. And Hardison's like, I didn't say he lost money. So Nate goes out to this, you know, this man's beautiful house somewhere to confront him. And we find out that he had surveillance on Pearson, who was the real victim in the Nigerian job. And so he had him being watched. And so he saw how everything went down with Dubenich. And when Dubenich was crying about con men, con artists, he knew that he was telling the truth, but nobody else believed him. So it took him a little bit, he says, but he was able to figure out Hardison's pattern of hiding their tracks.
Right.
And he's been, you know, doing what we were saying, if you want to make money on stocks, he finds out who they're going to take down and he invests in the competitors of those businesses.
He does that or he shorts that company.
Yes. So he's
What I'm talking about is that you basically promise to purchase later. You're sort of selling before you own. And so you are promising to buy at a later price.
But then you don't?
You do.
Oh, you do. Okay.
You cover your short later on. But the idea is if you are doing a short sale, you basically say, I am selling at the current price. And then you have to purchase by a certain point, and you're betting that that price is going to be lower at that later date.
Okay.
And the problem with short sales, I mean, here's the thing about a normal stock purchase, is that your losses are limited. You can only lose what you've invested, right? So you buy $100 worth of shares, they go to zero, you've lost $100.
Okay.
If you sell short, it's a much bigger risk because theoretically your losses are infinite. So if you buy, if you sell at $10 on day one and on day 30, that stock is at 1,000, like your bet has gone the opposite way, you owe a lot of money. And it could be even more.
Okay.
If you bet wrong on a short sale, your losses are theoretically infinite.
Well, that makes me want to throw up.
It's a really...
And that's why you need to have insider knowledge before you do something like that?
You don't have to. There's plenty of people who sell short on a daily basis because they look at the world and they say, this product isn't going to sell, or this particular market position is untenable, or this particular, stock is overvalued. There's a whole raft of ways of looking at this. Mm-hmm. Any stock, or any, not just stock, but any market investment is risky, but a short sale is incredibly risky.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have insider knowledge.
Unless you have insider knowledge, which is what this guy has been making so much money with.
Yep.
And he wants, so Nate's like, stay out of my business. And he throws his tumbler of whiskey into the yard. after he finishes it, because waste.
Of course. Waste,
not Nate Ford. And he's like, but I, like, this insider knowledge stuff goes both ways, because he knows about businesses who have been so good at covering their tracks that, like, the people who've been murdered don't know they've been murdered.
Right.
And he can give that information to Nate. And what he wants is 24 hours notice before. And he says, before you like descend from heaven with blood tipped wings. And he just has a great little quote there. He wants a call 24 hours at a time so he can make his move.
Right.
You know, if he's going to short or if he's going to invest in a competitor.
Yeah.
And Nate's like, no. And he's like walking away, you know, it doesn't say anything actually. And he's, so then Latimer gets this last line of the episode. He says, is your pride more important than helping people? Mm-hmm. And then Nate walks off. And then we're all left with like, God, is it? I don't know. Like
a wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then that's going to set up things for the rest of the season, really.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh, so good. It's so good.
Yeah. Because this is like about halfway through the season, I guess.
I feel like this season is longer than others. It might not be. But I was looking at the list for the rest of the episodes, and I was just like, I feel like we should be more than halfway through, but we're not.
Because they do that. I mean, the writers' room is so good, and they did do these sort of pivots.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the season, it wasn't usually just one sort of long arc. There was usually a twist somewhere around mid-season that sent everybody in a kind of a different direction. And it's one of the reasons why this show is just so good, because it just kept everything fresh, and it wasn't just sort of one thing after another until the inevitable end of the season, blah, blah, blah. It was okay, we're going in this direction. Oh, wait. Oh, there's some new information. Let's go in this other direction. So there was depth and complexity to it.
Yeah. And I think the best shows, when they can do that, like that's what makes shows really good, where there is like a season long arc, but it does lead you in different directions. But then you also just have standalone episodes.
Yeah.
That have nothing to do with that plot. Maybe they'll have like one little thing at the end, but maybe they won't. And you know, it's I feel like the best seasons of the X-Files were like that, where there's like a conspiracy going on. It's okay, but there's always like an ongoing conspiracy that Mulder's chasing, but then there's like a random comedy episode or a Monster of the Week episode where they're like, you know, they're at a freak show and they have to solve a random mystery, and it has nothing to do with alien conspiracies.
Well, and that's the nature of the beast, you know, beyond just the narrative storytelling, there's also the business of it, which is that you have budgets and you need to occasionally do what they call a bottle episode, which is, you know, essentially an episode that exists in one set, because that's a lot cheaper to do. And so what was the Irish Mob episode? Wasn't quite a bottle episode, but I know it was sold to John Rogers.
Called the Bottle Job.
Yes. Well, that's, yes. And it was actually sold to John
Rogers. It's a bottle episode. Yeah.
It's almost a bottle episode, because it was, you know, snowstorm. It's in the bar. It's in the bar and in the apartment, which is
and they made the new set with the room behind the bar.
Yes,
that became so great that they kept it. They built it again and kept it as a permanent part of that set. Yeah, and I think those bottle episodes, or those episodes that don't have anything to do with the overarching line of a season, are really good for bringing in new viewers. So like in Doctor Who, there's an episode called Blink that is a standalone episode in season 3 with Martha, but Martha and the Doctor are barely in it, and it is the perfect episode to start people off with Doctor Who who've never seen it before, because you don't need to know anything about the mythology of Doctor Who or the history of it. You can just sit someone down and be like, this is a horror episode, you're going to be terrified, and you're going to want to know more about what's going on in this world, and then you can start back wherever with whatever doctor you want.
Fun fact about Doctor Who is that there's always, I think there's either one or two episodes where the Doctor and his companion, because Martha's barely in that one too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's just like at the end.
One or two episodes, I can't remember what the number is, where contractually the Doctor and the companion are only in it for a very brief amount of time.
Really?
Every season.
I mean, yes, I can definitely, well, what's in the first season?
I can't recall, but it is totally a thing. It is absolutely a thing about Doctor Who, is that they have those episodes because they basically need to give them a break.
Yeah. And there's like, well, Midnight in season 4 doesn't have Donna in it very much, but it does. It's very Doctor heavy. But God, that's a bottle episode that I want to see like on stage where they're in the shuttle and the alien has like gets into people.
Repeating thing. Yeah.
Oh my God. That episode is so well written. It's so tightly done that I'm,
I think the reason why I'm glitching on one or two is I think that there is an episode where the Doctor is barely present, and mm-hmm. there's an episode where the companion is barely present, and Blink happens to be an instance of where it was both.
Yeah,
managed to both in the one episode. But yeah, that's a whole thing with that particular show that I remember reading about a while ago.
And that's trivia I did not know about Doctor Who, and I'm so excited. There's still new things for me to learn.
Hey. I love this show.
Do you have anything for a high slate?
So you mentioned at the beginning of the Big Short. I'm trying to think about, is there any books or other media about markets? I'm not coming up with anything. I will, but you know, I can say, you know, don't do insider trading.
There we go.
It's a bad thing. And actually what's really interesting is that even way, way back when I started working in and around stock markets and working for publicly traded companies, and I was exposed to a training video that the SEC made that makes the dancing bear people look like Oscar winners. Okay? Because it was actually a corporate training video created by the SEC, which highlighted their... It had like these scenarios of like this chief financial officer's secretary who's like chatting with her neighbor and he's got money troubles, and she's like, oh, well, I've been typing up our annual report and I know that we're actually going to surprisingly have a very good quarter or a very good year, and you know, yada yada yada. So he invests, and this was the late 90s, okay, and the ability that the SEC had at that time to trace unusual trades and match them to potential leaks, essentially, just even by zip code, was pretty astonishing even then.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and this video was intended to put the fear of God into people in terms of like what the SEC could do. Like, don't do this, essentially. Because I can tell you, anybody who's in this kind of enforcement area is sort of like, we don't want you, we're not looking to trap you into doing this. We just don't want you to do it. Don't do it.
Do it accidentally. Like,
yeah.
Just don't do it.
But yeah, so their ability back then to trace dodgy trades, because, you know, you take somebody who's been in index funds for their entire life or has never traded the market, and all of a sudden they make a really astonishingly big trade that makes them a lot of money and it is unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
They're on that like a laser.
Yeah.
It just throws up all kinds of flags, and they're going to be on you, and they're going to be like, oh, okay, who are your neighbors?
Who are your neighbors?
I can tell you that I, having worked at the NASDAQ stock market, a few years after I left, I had a colleague who was done for insider trading because he knew stuff about what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he traded via his wife's account. It was one of those things where I'm like, okay, first of all,
you're like, I could have done a better job of this. Come on.
Yeah. Like you, if you're going to do crime, do it like a smart person. Don't do it like an idiot. I mean, don't do crime. Just don't do crime. But
don't do crime.
It pinged all of my, what kind of, how stupid do you think? What? Yeah. So yeah, if you go back, it's all public knowledge. The guy's name was actually Don Johnson.
That's great.
Not even kidding. He's a former colleague of mine. And yeah, so he was done for insider trading. He's out by now.
Don't do it again, Don.
No.
Don't do it again.
So let me do my highlight really quick, and then I'll let you go to dinner.
Yeah.
But when I started talking about Sherman's lineage and how he has a direct line from the Yellow Kid, just pinged something. I was like, is that real? So I looked it up. The Yellow Kid was a real grifter and con artist.
Black box, or is it ledger? This is
exactly
a black box.
This is a black box. And so his name was Joseph Weil. He was born July 1st, 1875, and he died in February of 1976. So he lived to be 100.
Dang.
I know. Only the good die young, I guess. So there's so many like fascinating things about him that I could go into forever. They say in the episode that he conned people out of $10 million. Wikipedia and other things have been telling me $8 million. That's still a lot of millions.
Many million dollars.
That's so much. So he was born in Chicago, and one of my favorite rumors about him is that like in 1889, so he was still pretty young, he managed to sell a chicken to a wealthy prospector who was passing through Illinois, and he sold it to him for the price of a golden nugget. So, and it's from this rumor that we get the term chicken nugget.
What?
So I have no idea how true that is, but I love that.
That makes no sense.
I know. So he quit school and got work in Chicago's bustling loan shark industry when he was just 17. And then he started like
taking.
As one does. And then he started taking hush money from his coworkers who were skimming off the top at their jobs. So he's like, I won't tell the boss if you give me your money. And then he grew from there. He got the nickname the Yellow Kid because he was working with another grifter whose name was Frank Hogan. And there was a popular comic strip series called Hogan's Alley and the Yellow Kid, which was set in New York City. And obviously the main character's name was Hogan, or the area was named Hogan. But there was a little boy who's called the Yellow Kid who wore like the long yellow shirt and had his head shaved for life. And so he hung out with a guy named Hogan, so he became the Yellow Kid. Other sources said it was because he wore all yellow, but he, in his own autobiography, Vile says, that's not why. I never did that, and I never had a yellow beard. So he did a bunch of different things, and he claims that the only reason that he kind of like claimed a very leverage kind of thing, like the only people that he stole from were people who were greedy enough to be stolen from. Like if they didn't expect to get something for nothing, they wouldn't have been conned.
Got it.
In his 100 years, he only spent a total of 6 years in jail, just like little bits here and there, which is amazing. There are several books about him. So you can go out, including his own autobiography. So if you want to read those, you can. But my other favorite tidbit, besides the chicken nugget story, is that he once conned Benito Mussolini out of $2 million.
Wow.
Which is amazing. I just think that's great. And he lived till he was 100, and he didn't regret any of it. He would have done it all over again.
So I will add just really randomly to this recommendation section of the podcast. Since he did con Benito Mussolini, I would add the movie Tea with Mussolini as a possible viewing suggestion during this coronavirus pandemic. I have no idea where it is streaming. I saw it many years ago, I believe, maybe in the theater. But it is a very interesting and entertaining movie about fascism.
All right.
And it stars, you know, Cher. So,
hey. Yeah, there you go. And Italy, we're all thinking about Italy in this time.
Yes.
Yeah. Several of the other people that Sherman names, the greats, in of con artists, I was able to find like a little bit, like they were real people. Specifically, not Titanic, but Wildfire John was a real person. He's mentioned in the book. He was mentioned in the book *The Big Con* by David W. Moore, which I haven't read yet, but it's definitely on my list of books to read about con artists. So I just thought it was really cool that they were able to work in actual con artists who we know the names of, to kind of prove this guy's pedigree. But yeah, and that's it for my high slate. Adele, thank you so much for being on again. It is always wonderful when you're here, and I'm so glad you're back.
I always love chatting with you. It's so much fun, and you know, okay.
Yay. Tell people where they can find you online.
I am at _ Adele Buck on both Instagram and Twitter. My very lightly populated website/blog is adelebuck.com. Maybe someday my books will be out there in the world. I continue to write them. My agent continues to try to flog them to New York editors. We'll get there someday.
Fingers crossed. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. We're putting that out there in the world and visualizing it.
We are.
And I'm Christina, but I'm on Twitter at LibrarianC. And you won't see us again, but you'll hear us again in 2 weeks with the Cross My Heart job. And Robin's going to be back for that one. So thank you again, and go off, eat your dinner, enjoy the Friday off.
Thank you for having me. It's always lovely.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
But to like pivot to like a happier thing, I just checked on the website that hosts the podcast, and you can like see your stats. Mm-hmm. And some weeks I like obsessively check every day, like, aha, did anybody listen this week or today? But I haven't checked in probably since a couple days after I posted the last episode. but on the 6th, there were 102 downloads.
Wow.
And it looks like, because you can see how many, what episodes and how many times they were downloaded. Sure. And it looked like two people went all the way through probably the entire thing and downloaded all of them.
Everything. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so you can also see like geographically where they are. There's two people in Saudi Arabia who on the 6th just decided, you know what? This is the podcast. Maybe we're going to listen to it and talk to each other about it. I have no idea.
So. Two Liverage fans in Saudi. Oh my God. How amazing.
Yeah. So welcome.
That's incredible. Oh
yeah. I have a couple. I have one like really regular person in Israel who like the day after I upload, I always can go and there's like just one person from Israel. Most people are from the US, but I've got people, there are people in Australia, in Spain, in Switzerland.
I wanted to give a little shout out to the international crowd at the beginning of this because of these stats. Why not? I mean, just because I think are probably, you know, if I hadn't really thought about it, but I kind of originally thought about it as if I were to say who I thought the audience would be, it would be US. But
Yeah, and a large portion are the US, which is awesome. Obviously, and I mean, because we are all from the US, a lot of our experiences and the things that we talk about are very
I mean, mine are all like Texas-based. I'm like, if it's not Texas, I don't understand. Yeah. So it's really cool to see that other people are listening. And I may be understanding Texas and the United States better, or, you know, yelling at their phones, like, what's wrong with you?
I'm American. I don't understand Texas, I admit. I just, it's that whole ad campaign where they said it's a whole other country. And I was like, yeah.
It is. I don't even understand that all the time. And I'll blame that on being first generation. But yeah, I love our international listeners. I love all of our listeners. So thank you. It's really interesting to imagine other leverage fans around the world.
Yeah, that's cool. That's the whole sort of universality of humanity. I mean, I know not everybody's experience on anything is universal, but that this show crosses cultural lines and, you know, finds its appeal in a non-US audience, that's neat.
Yeah, I like to think that, you know, wanting good people to win and bad people to be punished for their hubris and their bad deeds,
and their, yeah, so
that feels pretty universal.
Yeah.
Across cultures. Just, especially like in this time of pandemic.
And you know, and I think that's really important. And I think that also, you know, podcasts that kind of pull people together via a shared experience is another sort of virtual warm hug, because we can't hug each other, because we can't get within 6 feet of each other, or 2 meters, depending upon if you're American or somebody who has a logical system of measurement. So, yeah.